Time to take a look at your pet's health. Hi, Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Dr. Zandi Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Pleased to have her back again. And certainly, if you have a question for her as we move along today, I hope you'll join in. Lots of open lines at the moment, but they soon won't be, I'm pretty sure. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area at 263-1890. We'd be pleased to have you on the air. Dr. Zandi Sawchuk, welcome back.
It's nice to be back.
You know, I mentioned before this show that dogs and cats have allergies or can have allergies as well.
They sure do. About 1 out of 5 pets will have allergies. And what's interesting about it, though, is most people that have allergies get hay fever and those type of symptoms, runny nose, itchy eyes. Dogs and cats will primarily have skin issues. Their big allergy organ is their skin. We do sometimes see some respiratory things, but usually it's just being itchy. Itchy ears, itchy feet. Those are probably the two big areas, but it could be just about anywhere. They'll be rubbing their face on the ground and so on. And then what'll happen is they'll get secondary bacterial infections and yeast infections, and it becomes a big mess. So, you know, it's something that we don't usually see in puppies. It's not until they get to be a year, 2 years of age, and eventually starts to get, you know, worse, and the season lasts longer. And yeah, it can be a real problem for owners to deal with. And certain breeds are more predisposed to it than others. The poster child for allergies are the Labrador Retriever and the Golden Retriever. So, you know, people that have those dogs are well versed in, you know, how to deal with their dog when they're itchy like this in the summertime.
Are there medications for it then? Or?
There are. Unfortunately, though, most of the things like antihistamines that we would take don't work that well in dogs because histamine isn't the only allergy mediator chemical in the dog. For us, that's the main thing that causes our eyes and nose to run. So we can take an antihistamine and do fine. Dogs, it's going to take the edge off of it, but not going to help them that much. But because most of their symptoms are superficial, ears and feet, the big thing that we use is steroid drops in the ears, steroid sprays on the feet. Try not to go with steroids internally unless it's just for a very brief period of time because of their side effects. Back it up with antihistamines. Sometimes even doing things like adding a fatty acid supplement will help as well. Fish oil supplements, which are very inexpensive. Mm-hmm. You can get some commercially available ones too that are a little more expensive. But for my own dogs, I just buy the over-the-counter stuff at one of the big warehouse stores, you know, and use those. And, you know, it's going to help the dog, just make them feel a little more comfortable. Eventually, though, if the dog is not being able to be kept comfortable, or the cat, I should say, I shouldn't be leaving cats out, you may want to be looking at getting some allergy testing done to find out exactly what the dog is or cat is allergic to. There's a blood test that can be done and then some follow-up skin testing, just like they do for us, little injections. But we don't use their back. We use kind of their side because that's where their rib cage is. Yeah.
So ways to deal with it. Let's go to Dave in Livingston. Dave, hi. Thanks for calling.
How's it going?
Good.
I have a stray cat that's been outside my property. I've started feeding it, and it seems to be quite tame. But the issue I'm having is there's large patches of fur that are missing as far as it appears to be scratching itself most constantly. The fur on its belly's gone, behind its ears, of course, up on its shoulders.
Oh, boy.
Mangy?
I thought mange, but the thing is, you know, be it that it is a, you know, truly a stray cat, and I already have two cats inside my house.
Yeah.
You know, and then plus they're males. It's not like I could really bring them in. It seems like a former house cat because you can pet them, do whatever. I've just been doing it with vet's gloves on and washing thoroughly afterwards.
Yeah, good for you for not bringing, trying to take care of this little guy, but not bringing him in to have your cats infected. There's so many things that we worry about besides the obvious with him having skin issues. Does he have fleas? Does he have ear mites? Does he have scabies? Is it a boy for sure? Is it a girl? Maybe sometimes girls that are in heat and being mated will have the hair pulled out on their upper back, and that could be why she or he is missing some hair back there. If it's a girl, that's a possibility.
Actually, it's definitely a male.
It is a male. Okay. Yeah. So it could be that he's just been getting into fights with other cats and losing hair from that, but there definitely could be something contagious. Besides that, we also want to make sure that he doesn't come with any infectious diseases that could be a problem problem for your cat. The two big ones that we worry about are feline leukemia virus and FIV virus, which is sort of like our human HIV virus. And there's a blood test that can be done to make sure that this stray cat is negative for that. You know, getting intestinal parasite screens done by having a stool sample checked. And then, you know, then you get all to the behavior issues that if you do decide this cat has a clean bill of health, how do you introduce them to your cats? Slowly, okay? Let them get used to the fact that there's a new cat in the household by having the new cat isolated in another room if you're even contemplating adopting him. But, you know, if you can get him in a carrier, I think that would be the best bet. Either get him to the shelter where he can receive some medical care, because it sounds like he's pretty miserable right now.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, though, I'm kind of concerned. I've been taking care of him now for over 2 months. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I figured with a good diet, you know, I give him milk every day, food. He basically hangs out on my back porch. But the thing is, just the massive hair loss. I mean, I thought it was mange, whatever, and I was thinking about taking him to a vet. But be it that he is stray, you know, and he's probably been outside for quite a while.
Now, I am not, I'm not a lawyer, but my take is that if you've been feeding the cat for 2 months and it's been living on your back porch, legally it's yours, okay? So I think you may want to consider, rather than just saying the stray, give him a name and get him to a vet. And that way you can get to the bottom of this and not just be scratching your head and wondering, you know, am I scratching my head because something I got from him? No. So get him in. Get him checked out.
Good luck, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. Rick and Holman, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great, thanks for calling.
Yep. My question is about, I have a 2-year-old Shih Tzu, and it's not really a skin allergy. The vet, I've been to two different vets, and they call it an inverted sneeze.
Oh.
And there's nothing they can do about it. And it's almost like a runny eye nose thing where they snort backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I'm talking about?
I can make the sound on the radio if you want me to.
I could too.
All right. Well, let's hear yours and see if it's better. Yep. There you go.
Like a pig snort.
You got it. Well, I tell you what's happening. I have two bulldogs, so a very similar type upper respiratory conformation as a Shih Tzu, the pushed-in face dogs. What's happening is the soft palate, the roof of the mouth, is getting trapped up over the epiglottis. So the dog is feeling like it's, as it's breathing, this thing is kind of stuck in its airway.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do this snorting type sound. We'll see this for in a number of dogs for different reasons. Sometimes it's just that they've got an elongated soft palate because of conformation, and they're busy sniffing. They have their head in a certain position. Beagles do it a lot when they've got their nose down and sniffing. It'll get flipped up into position. If you can get them to swallow, massage their neck, it will usually go back to where it belongs, and then everybody's happy. Sometimes we will see dogs that will do this reverse sneezing frequently, and it'll go, you know, instead of just being once or twice a week, it goes, it's like all day long they're doing it.
It's not that bad.
Yeah, well, then when we start seeing that, some of these dogs, we've actually gone in, knocked them out with a little light anesthetic and gone back and have a look and found that their soft palate is red and swollen, and that's why it's getting caught. And we had one dog where the surgeons had to do a soft palate resection, actually take a piece of the soft palate out of there to allow the dog to be able to breathe properly.
Hmm.
But if you're seeing it seasonal, that it's worse at certain times of the year.
It's seasonal.
Yeah, it may be that your dog does have allergies. Remember I said, even though dogs typically get the skin and ear form, we do sometimes see some upper respiratory signs. You know, the eyes will get a little more runny. I know my dogs, they get some eye inflammation with allergies. And if they've got, your dog's got a little nasal inflammation, that could be causing that soft palate to be a little flabbier than normal. And that's what's resulting in the reverse sneezing.
Yeah, it was like really bad in the spring. And now the closer we get into summer, it's less and less, and now it doesn't happen hardly at all.
Well, good. It's not life-threatening, so nothing to worry about. It just sounds horrible.
That's why I thought it was like an allergy, and the vets were like, they weren't saying the word allergy, but it felt like an allergy to me.
My dog probably has a little rhinitis, okay? So they just want to use the right terminology. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Rick. Carolyn DeForest, your turn now. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have a little black mini schnauzer, and we just had his teeth cleaned at the vet, and I don't want to do that again if possible. I'd like to know the best way to eliminate that tartar on his teeth without having to have a thorough cleaning by the veterinarian, or is this something that I just have to think about every couple years? They gave me a bunch of ideas, like brushing his teeth and chewing things. I want the least expensive, easiest, best for him method.
Well, you know, I go into the dentist regardless every 6 months for teeth cleaning, and it's amazing. I floss. I'm a compulsive flosser. I brush two or three times a day, and they still find dental tartar on my teeth. You'll hear the little click, click, click. You know, maybe you don't see it as much as you do in dogs. So it's a given that even with good hygiene, dental care may still be needed as the dog gets older. The unique thing about Schnauzers is that they have, I don't know how you have your dog groomed, but if you're keeping him in the typical Schnauzer cut with the big mustache, they'll get a lot of hair in their mouth, and that'll help trap food particles and bacteria. So you may want to, your dog may look a little funny, but next time you go into the groomer, go with the clean-shaven look. You may find that that'll help with dental hygiene a little bit better. Brushing, by all means, is probably your best bet of keeping the teeth under control. And we mean daily brushing, getting in there, not just doing the front teeth, but those back teeth as well. And it's training the dog to be comfortable with the brush that's going to be the trick, and training you to put it into your busy schedule. There are diets on the market that may help as well. The two things you want to be looking for, and there's a couple of diets out there now that actually approach dental hygiene both ways. One is mechanical cleaning. And that would be things like your science diet, oral care. There's a prescription diet called TD. They're bigger chunks of food with a fiber matrix that doesn't fall apart when it's hit by a tooth. It kind of encases the tooth and squeegees it clean rather than just breaking. So that helps for some dogs. But they, again, they have to chew it. And if your dog's like mine that sometimes just swallow the food whole, it's not going to do any good. There's also another way where there's anti-plaque agents incorporated into diets. The one in dog food, you'll find if you're reading the labels, it'll say hexametaphosphate, HMP. For cats, it's called pyrophosphates, is typically what you'll find. And those are actually anti-plaque agents just on the surface of the food, come in contact with the saliva. It binds the minerals in the saliva so that the plaque on the teeth becomes less mineralized, more porous, so it comes off easier with brushing and, you know, and so on. So looking for a diet that has that will be helpful too. And also mechanical stuff, such as rawhide chips, if your dog will tolerate it.
Rawhide chips, any other kind of chews that are good for that?
Well, I'm not that I'm going to recommend. Rawhide, okay. The flat chews seem to be the safest for less tooth breakage, but they also can choke on them if they swallow them whole.
Okay.
So you as a consumer have to know your dog's chewing capabilities before you start introducing something like that.
Do any of the treat-type chews work in that way?
Well, there are some, but they're really high in calories. So be careful when you're getting some of these things like Busy Bones and some of these other ones that are out there. And the harder the object, the greater the chance of tooth breakage as well.
Okay.
So be careful with that. Lastly, if you do go in for a dental cleaning, there's a product on the market called Oravet. I think that's Oravet. And it's made by a company called Mariel. It's a lacquer that gets painted on the teeth, and it acts like, I mean, the best, I'm going to probably have the Teflon police after me because I'm using a proprietary term, but it's like Teflon. It just, everything just slides off the tooth, and you can paint this on the teeth when they're asleep, when they're under anesthesia, and then the owner gets a take-home kit to go home with some swabs, and you just kind of reapply it and keep that layer on the teeth. That really helps. It's not cheap, but it's a very helpful tool for keeping the teeth clean.
Okay. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks, Carol. Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call if you'd like to join in, or in Madison at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Lots of people online, so we'll go right back to the phones. And Sarah and Baronet, hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 5-year-old Pomeranian, and she's been to the vet a couple times. She's losing her hair, and what it appears to be is the alopecia X, black skin disease. There is a dearth of information on the web on how to deal with this. A lot of vets just say, well, it's, you know, cosmetic and not to worry about it. She does have most of her guard hairs, but most of her undercoat on her sides in around her tail and her hind legs is just gone.
Uh-huh.
You know, she's got a very thin coat, so she looks kind of funny. Or, you know, her ruff and her head is fine.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of the things I've seen is the use of melatonin.
Right.
Does it work?
Well, interesting that you bring this up. Last February, I adopted a new dog. Her name is Vanna, and she's a white bulldog, and it's very common for bulldogs, and what they call it in bulldogs is seasonal flank alopecia.
Mm-hmm.
She has permanent hair loss on her flanks, like up on either side of her back, and it actually gets bigger in the winter and smaller in the summer, and you know, then the hair after you go through a few seasons, just doesn't grow back.
Right.
And it's a similar type condition in Pomeranians too. If they've ruled out every other cause for this,
her skin looks very healthy.
Yeah, but it just becomes kind of a darker, hairless, pigmented area.
Right. Her skin, she's black and white.
Yeah.
Mostly white.
Yeah.
And the skin was normally pink, but it's now turned like a Holstein cow.
Right.
Underneath.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know melatonin is used, and it can be used with some success early on. But once the follicles have been, you know, damaged, they may not grow back,
mm-hmm.
even with using melatonin. It has something to do with, the brain and light exposure and hair growth cycles and so on. The downside of using melatonin, I've taken it once myself, so mm-hmm. I can speak as, you know, someone that has taken it. It's recommended for people to take with jet lag and things so that you get, you know, into the swing of the new area that you're in. Well, it made me really spacey and groggy. And that's the thing that you'll see in dogs as well, is it can make them a little groggy.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that melatonin's being used for is treating noise phobias in dogs, which is really interesting for thunderstorm phobias. Some dogs respond very well to this drug that you can just get over the counter. I'd always make sure that you talk to your veterinarian before you even use any over the counter drug.
Right.
But melatonin might be something that other people would be interested in using for that problem.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Sean in Fond du Lac. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
My roommate has a pit bull. And it itches itself constantly, and to the point where its back, its ears, its head, and its toes are bleeding constantly.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, and, I mean, it itches itself on walls, on chairs. The vet said that he should give the dog over-the-counter antihistamines, but for the last month, it seems not to work, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Well, if you were to come in and see me, the first thing I would do is probably take a history and just see if this is more seasonal or whether it's year-round. Seasonal will make me think more of allergies. Year-round, less likely environmental allergies, possibly food allergies, though, and it's not the food that's an ingredient in the food, like a protein source that pets can be allergic to. But I'd also be worried about other things, such as external parasites. I'd be doing some skin scrapings to look for parasites like scabies, maybe even considering a therapeutic trial for scabies as well, because they're hard to find. They're little tiny microscopic insects that live on the surface of the skin. Most owners are itching too, though, because this can be contagious to owners. After I've done that, I would do some impression smears to look for an infectious cause such as bacteria or yeast, which may just be the primary cause, or they may be there because the dog has allergies and has broken the skin open and set up some problems. Getting those treated as well may involve using a month-long round of antibiotics, sometimes antifungal agents, special shampoos to be able to get under control. So, you know, just saying to use antihistamines without doing any diagnostic work, I think is not in the dog's best interest. So time to go back to the veterinarian and say, let's do a dermatologic workup and see if we can figure out what's going on here and treat the dog appropriately.
Now, we are all college students, so we have a hard time making money. Do you recommend any sort of clinic that would have discounts for college students?
Oh, boy. You know, and this is one of the big concerns about adopting a pet is, you know, the financial implications of having one. And it's sad when I get patients in that I know I can help, but it all comes down to the bottom line. I always recommend that if you are getting a pet and money's going to be tight, get pet insurance. I even have pet insurance for my pets, mm-hmm. and I'm a veterinarian, but I don't do surgery. So I have that as my backup, so I don't have to pay an expensive surgery bill at some point. I don't know of any clinics. What I would recommend is calling your local animal shelter. They sometimes have their, you know, finger on the community to find out maybe, you know, if there is, you know, any funding or anything for people that are on limited incomes.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Lots of things to think about there. Sally in Wisconsin Dells. Hi to you.
Hi. I just moved here from Chicago. I retired and I moved up here. And last week I was reading in my local newspaper about an animal abuse case that will be, the man has to appear in the Juneau County Courthouse on July 9th. In Illinois, I would appear or I would go to the courthouses when there was animal abuse cases to be heard. And as a group, we would just sit there and let the judge know that there are citizens concerned about animal abuse cases and mm-hmm. so that these guys just didn't get a slap on the wrist. Now, I'm interested in some kind of group here in Wisconsin. Do you know of any that I can contact?
I don't. But again, you know, just like the last person, contacting your local shelter or your humane officer, and they will sometimes, because they're involved in these cases and may be getting contacted by community members, they may be able to put you in touch with local people that are, you know, doing this type of work. I don't know of anybody, and I apologize that I don't know. But
somebody else listening may know and will call in.
Give us a call.
Yeah, stay listening, Sally.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. We'll see. We mm-hmm. often get calls like that.
Mm-hmm.
Tom in Columbus, hi to you.
Good morning, Dr. Sachek, Larry.
Hello.
Hi. Great.
First, I've got a couple of points. First of all, there is funding available for people that need some assistance. I can't right off the top of my head tell you what the .com is to go to or .org to go to. I do know that my kid brother used it when his shepherd needed hip surgery, and I think it was a $600 surgery bill, and the place covered half. The organization covered half. And our veterinarian in Columbus, Wisconsin, he probably would know who to contact, and I don't use him anymore. I go to a vet on Prairie with our dog.
Uh-huh.
But I would think maybe that the some vets would have some information on that. And if I do have find that information out, what I'll do is I'll send something to Larry on his email, and maybe he can post it somehow. But I want to reemphasize the point that you brought up, Ms. Sawchuk, about the rawhide shoes. We have a golden lab, and she's full grown. A lot of her problems are behavioral, unfortunately, but that they were caused by the previous owner. But she did, she didn't do the standard or the universal holding her hand up to her throat to signify she was choking. Mm-hmm. But she had a rawhide and kind of opened her mouth, and nothing was coming out. And my wife recognized it right away and had enough thought, process between the panic to run to the kitchen junk drawer and grab basically a hemostat that we had in there. I tinker around with electronics and pried the dog's mouth open a little bit more, reached in there and pulled it out. And, it was about three-quarters of the way softened. And, it stuck right in there just like a noodle or something.
Cork.
And
prompted
her to go to the library and kind of motivated her a little bit to look into stuff things that we can do to offset the cost of owning the pet that normally people would do that would take it to the vet to have things done. Even as simple as clipping the toenails, as long as you're careful.
Right.
The daily brushing, stuff like that. There are a lot of things you can do yourself, but of course, you're not spaying and neutering or anything like that.
No, but preventive care, it really it pays off. And probably one of the things that is the easiest thing you can do is keep your dog or cat in good physical shape. Don't let them get overweight. We see so many problems that we've got an obese animal that's ruptured its anterior cruciate, and and now they're looking at a $3,000 veterinary bill.
Right.
We had a
Dalmatian prior to this, and he was 62 pounds from the day we adopted him till the time that we ended up putting him down, and he lived to about 16. And our vet at the time said, just keeping him in shape not only accounted possibly for an additional year or two, but just his quality of life. I mean, he never had joint trouble. He never, had the odor, bad breath problems. He never had a ton of things that could go with being out of shape.
Right. So, well, the dogs will live 15% longer keeping them slender. Unbelievable. So 15% longer.
Thank you much. Great.
Thank you for the info.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Thanks for calling. And you can join in, by the way, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Mike in Richland Center, you are next. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I have a terrier chihuahua cross. She's a female, weighs about 12 pounds. She loves pitted, dried apricots. Are these harmful to her?
No, they shouldn't be if they're, you know, if they've got the pit out of them and they're dry. The thing is, they're high in calories. And so, and if she's a chihuahua that's 12 pounds, well, she's a mix. So, you know, if she's carrying an extra weight, then even though she loves those things,
we cut them down. We don't let her have all she wants.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that as long as 90% of her diet is coming from, you know, a well-balanced food, adding a few apricots in, hey, it's like me having a little chocolate once in a while. You know, you just got it's all moderation. Yeah.
Okay, that's what we do.
Okay.
Good for you.
But, you know, there are some things you got to be really careful with dogs. And, you know, one of the things that I found out about, which is really interesting, is that did you know that dogs are very sensitive to macadamia nuts. Yeah. That, you know, it's just even just a gram of macadamia nuts per pound of body weight, which is not very many. When I can sit down and polish off a whole container from the grocery store, they can become lethargic, vomit, and increase body temperature, progress to loss of coordination, tremors, profound weakness. So, if dogs are the only species that they know are sensitive to macadamia nuts.
Oh,
so
darn.
Next time you go to Hawaii, don't bring that back for your dog.
Right.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for calling. Mike mentioned that he had a mixed breed dog, and there are some DNA tests out there now for
this
mixed breed.
This is so cool.
Yeah.
I know. You know, everybody comes in with their mixed breed dogs, and they're like, I wonder what it is. And we kind of, oh, it's a husky, you know, and you try to come up with what it is. There is a new test that's going to be available for veterinarians to do for owners where we would send it off with just a little blood sample. It's called the Wisdom Panel. And the Mars company, they make pet food as well as
candies
and so on, have got a veterinary division now, and they've invested a lot of work into this DNA testing. And there's a website that people can go to called www.whatsmydog, no apostrophe, just whatsmydog, all small letters, .com. And, you know, that answers some questions on it. But they are able to recognize, detect over 130 different breeds. So not every breed, but over 130. And it's about 95% accurate. And it's just a little blood test. I don't know what it's going to cost yet. But, you know, I would guess $100 or so. Yeah. And you know, it may just be something that you can use for, you know, cocktail party information. This is what my dog has in it. But, you know, there are certain breeds of dogs that have various nutritional needs and health problems that we could then start paying attention to and be monitoring for. If we know, you know, like soft coat and Wheaton Terriers as a breed have a lot of problems with their kidneys and intestinal tract. And so we can start monitoring for, you know, signs that we've got issues going down, you know, for that problem. You know, that's just one example, but I think it's really cool to be able to have that test available. Yeah.
Steve in Fish Lake, your turn now. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, thank you much. I'm really concerned about the necessary evil of these anti-tick and anti-flea ointments that get spread from the collarbone down to the tip of the tail on the dog. And I haven't gone online to research it, but I've got the active ingredients in one is permethrin, and another active ingredient in a different product is imidacloprid.
Imidacloprid.
The third one is methoprene.
Okay.
And when I give the dog the one with the permethrin in it, he seems to be really lethargic for the following day.
Like,
it really bothers him.
Yeah.
So, which of these is the most effective, or by contrast, which is the least harmful to the dog itself?
Really good question. And you have to know the species you're dealing with, especially, I mean, if you can't recognize that you've got a cat and a dog versus a dog, then, you know, you shouldn't even be owning pets. But you have to be careful because there's a lot of dog products you can't use on cats. And you have to base most of the flea and tick products are based on weight, and you need to have a fairly accurate weight of your pet to know that you're getting the appropriate dose. The products that you mentioned, imidacloprid, is what's in Advantage. Advantage is now an over-the-counter flea and tick, or flea product, just fleas, that's available for cats and for dogs. They've upped the ante in areas where ticks are a problem, such as us, where we live here, by adding in to this product permethrin, which is a synthetic pyrethrin, very toxic for cats. We can only use it in dogs. And so that product is called Advantix, and Advantix will get fleas and ticks. Permethrin is absorbed through the skin. It is absorbed systemically. It can, at high levels, be a neurotoxin. And your dog may have a little bit of a hypersensitivity reaction to it. So that particular product may not be the best one for you to use. The other one that's out there that I like to use is called Frontline. Fipronil is the active ingredient. And they have added in an insect growth regulator to their product, which is the methoprene that you mentioned. That has no effect on dogs. What it does is it stops fleas, eggs, and larvae from being able to develop. And the reason why they've included that in there is that the product, you have to use it monthly for tick control, but you can go longer for flea control. And if people stretched it to the limit, you would see some failures, and dogs would, and cats would start to get fleas. So they put in this insect growth regulator to stop the environment from being infected. If you're using it monthly for tick control, then the methoprene isn't even necessary to have it in there, but it's there and you can't take it out. If you're having troubles with a product that contains permethrin, then definitely consider switching to using something like Frontline, and your dog may be able to handle that better. We do live in an area with lots of ticks, and I have been on a weekly basis diagnosing more and more pets with some of these tick-borne diseases, Lyme disease, Ehrlichia, anaplasma. People that don't even realize that their dogs have been bit by ticks, we're finding this when we're doing some screening. So, you know, be on the lookout, get ticks off as soon as you can, because even the using tick control religiously is not 100% effective.
Thank you very much.
Thanks much for calling. And on to Evelyn, I believe, is next in Racine. Hi, Evelyn.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling. We're very worried about our 2-year-old male German Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
He had, 3 weeks ago, he had a cyst removed from his back, which was totally benign, but it was under general anesthesia. And ever since then, he has no appetite. He was having an issue with diarrhea and prior to the surgery, which was cleared up with Endosorb, I believe. And he had, the stool was checked, and it was negative, and it was checked again after surgery, wondering, you know, why he's not eating. He's been to the vet last week, Friday, and checked the temperature and, you know, general checkup, and couldn't find anything wrong.
Did they do any lab work besides a stool check?
No.
I think that that needs to be done next. The fact that he is not eating, I mean, if he's truly totally anorectic, I get worried about a dog that's just undergone general anesthesia. Do they have some organ dysfunction? Do they have some liver problems, kidney issues, something like that that could be a problem? Sometimes during anesthetic, dogs will regurgitate and aspirate. Is he coughing at all? Does he have any respiratory difficulties?
No, he isn't. And he, you know, he has also, because of that, I mean, he'll eat like out of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've just tried everything, giving him chicken and whatever. But,
yeah.
He just is not as energetic.
I'd be getting him in and getting him checked out with some lab work. I think it's time to, you know, get, if it's been 2 weeks, start looking for some other underlying problem. And it means having him donate some blood and, you know, you spending a little money to get this diagnosed.
Mm. Yeah, it's...
Yep. Yeah. Better do it.
Yep.
What would that lab work be called?
Well, if you were to come in and see me, I'd probably be running a CBC, which is a complete blood cell count,
okay,
and a chemistry panel.
Okay.
And most likely requesting that if you can, even if, you know, before you bring some urine in with you as well. And so first morning urine catch, you can go out with a little tray or something and catch. All you need is maybe a teaspoon, and you can know a lot about the dog's health even from a urine sample. So if you bring that along, it may save the dog a little bit of problems when they get into the vet clinic. But just to be on the safe side, if they need to get a sterile urine sample, don't let him hit any of the bushes outside of the vet clinic when he's there. That's where dogs like to empty, because then we can't get the sample. So coming in with a full bladder is helpful as well.
Okay, and the CBC, and what was the other test?
Chemistry panel.
Oh, the panel. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, well, I thank you much.
Okay, good luck.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. And Dr. Fred in Madison, you are next. Hi there.
Hi, this is Dr. Fred Blanca. I'm referring back to your discussion about a poor stray cat denuded. We have had Lady Lucky, the same type of a cat. She was totally denuded. Mm-hmm. The skin was just hanging from her body. I took her to the vet. She is healthy, and she needed loving care, and she recovered totally.
Mm-hmm.
Loving care is the only thing that she needs. Can I give my phone number to you so that this poor man who has that wonderful little kitty calls me for advice?
Well,
sure.
Yeah.
Because,
okay, 608-249-0606. My cat was just unbelievably thankful that we took her in, and we called her Lady Lucky.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are conditions where, because cats are shedding animals, where if they go through a major stress in life, you know, they're sick, they're high fever, they're starving, you know, major, major stress, you can run into troubles where all their hair will, like, fall out all at once, and they'll go through a major shed to the point where they may be totally, I mean, bald in areas, mm-hmm. especially any place where there's a little bit of friction, like where a collar would be or whatever, the hair may fall out. And I can't remember what it's called, telogen effluvium, I think is what the dermatologic name is. I hope that's right. I have no idea. But we do see this once in a while, and that may be what was going on with your cat. And, you know, just the fact that this cat's itchy, though, makes me think that a little tender love and care probably isn't going to solve this cat's problem. I mean, it's going to be nice and make his quality of life much better, but it's probably not going to stop the itching.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling, Fred. Appreciate it. And we'll take some more calls, but just to remind you, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is our guest clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Sandy, you've got some more information for us on raw diets, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's some stuff that I find quite alarming. You know, we all know, I've mentioned it before, that even commercially available raw diets, you can go to pet stores and sometimes buy these frozen raw diets that are all pre-made for you, that when you look at these raw diets, that 53% of them you can find E. coli, 6% you can actually culture salmonella. Well, there was these people that took, and researchers that took the salmonella that they found from these commercially available raw diets, cultured it out, and developed lots of little platelet, you know, petri mm-hmm. dishes full of salmonella, and took it in inoculated stainless steel bowls, brand new stainless steel bowls, okay, which you would think you could clean really easily. And then they just said, well, what would the average owner do if they put the food in there and there was salmonella and then they dumped, you know, washed the bowl afterwards? How would they deal with it? And would the salmonella persist? And what they found is that if the control group, they put the salmonella in and then went back and recultured it, 100% of them they found salmonella in. 96% if you just did a warm water rinse still had salmonella. Even if you did a rinse and scrub, 96% still had salmonella. Scrub with a soap group, 79% still had salmonella. 10% bleach soak, 71% still had that same salmonella was able to be cultured from it. Putting the dish through the dishwasher, guess what? 67% still had salmonella on it. So then they looked at bleach plus scrubbing, okay, 42% still had salmonella. So I know for my pets, they don't even get their bowls washed every day.
Yeah.
So this is just a warning. If you are using a raw diet for your pets and you've chosen to do that for your own reasons, be aware that these the dishes, you should not be using your own dishes, because then if you put those back in the cabinet again and serve your own family food on it, they're going to have potential for salmonella. And that can be quite a problem for human beings. So dedicated pet bowls, you know, bleach, scrub, dishwasher, I mean, everything you can, and realize that there may still be bugs there. So don't let the kids handle them. Be careful with immunocompromised pets, and humans that are immunocompromised as well could cause some major health problems. So,
word to the wise.
Very scary. Yeah.
Very scary. Well, Bubba and Phillips, it's your turn next.
Hi, Dr. Sadchek.
Hi.
Hi, Larry. I got a little bit of an echo, so please forgive me if I get disrupted. But I was wondering if you could help educate our listeners on the condition of bloat, which happens to primarily barrel-chested dogs and is a twisting of the stomach and could be deadly if not treated quickly.
Well, yes. And it can be, you know, it's one of those things where if you get a dog such as a standard poodle, an Irish setter, these deep chested, not so much the barrel chested dogs, but the real deep, narrow chested dogs where the stomach is kind of hanging like a pendulum. Big things you want to be watching out for are, you know, the risks are single meals a day, you know, just feeding one big meal where you've got a wad of food going down in there, stress, eating and exercising after eating a meal. So we recommend, you know, multiple small meals a day, limiting exercise after eating. And another big risk factor is drinking a lot of water. I had a dog. I've worked in the past at a dog camp in northern Wisconsin called Dog Days of Wisconsin. And we would have the Doggy Olympics and dogs would be out and having a great time all day. And then they'd go back to their cabins or the areas where the owners were staying. Owners would go into the lodge and have dinner. Well, one of the dogs, which was a Bernese Mountain Dog, big barrel-chested dog, went back, not only drank its water bowl dry, but also drank the toilet down, you know, drank a lot, and ended up bloating and having to be transported, you know, through the North Woods over to an emergency clinic in Appleton. And it did survive, but it was really touch and go. So be careful if you've had a dog that's been outside exercising, even limiting the amount of water that the dog is getting to small amounts, letting it get into the system rather than letting it tank up on water. Most of the research that's been done looking at ingredients in the food, such as fermentable ingredients like soya, have not played out. They've not found that that's a real risk factor for dogs. It's more volume of food, exercise, and water intake, and stress after eating that seems to be the big cause.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate that call. I just wanted to mention for, I think it was Sally from Wisconsin Dells, the lady from Wisconsin Dells, who wondered about a support group for on abuse of animals. Someone else called in, didn't want to give their phone number over the air, but said, this woman from the Dells, if you call back our number, 1-800-642-1234, give our number a call. Jim Packard has the number of the person who can assist you on that support group. So just thought I'd let you know. And Mike in Oshkosh, you're next. Hi, Mike.
Hey, I have a question about a cat allergy. And thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a cat that has had allergies for about, I guess, 5 years. And I tried a beet and duck-type meal for a little while. There was no difference. And I get her, I believe it's a hormone shot, and they recommend that every 3 months, and that seems to stop.
Is it a steroid injection or a hormone injection?
Maybe steroid, yeah.
Steroid, okay, all right.
And they said there's a slight or a risk of getting diabetes.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But I get that. I try to wait every 3 months, but sometimes I have to double up.
Yeah.
And sometimes I have to go, you know.
Right. What it sounds
earlier.
Like your cat's bad enough that you may want to be considering allergy testing. I mentioned this earlier in the show. There's a blood test that can be done that gets sent off, as well as some skin testing to determine what your cat is actually allergic to. Then they can come up with some allergy shots that you may be able to give to your cat. We teach owners how to do it. And it can take a bit, several months for the cat to be able to respond to it. But, you know, people report 70, 80% improvement with their allergies by going that route. food allergies, if you are looking at, is this cat allergic to some dietary protein source, you have to be really careful. You're looking at 8 to 10 weeks of an elimination diet trial. And what I'd be recommending is one of the hydrolyzed protein diets that are available for cats. The one that comes to mind is called ZD. It's made by Hill's, and they've taken down the protein. I think it actually comes from poultry, but broken it down into smaller bits where the body doesn't recognize where it comes from. But they get that and only that and water for 8 to 10 weeks. And so if you didn't go through a feeding trial for that length of time, or you gave in and gave the cat some treats or something midway through, you pretty well undid all your food trial protocol. So maybe go back to the drawing board on that as well.
Okay. Would it be all right? I have two cats. Would it be all right for my other cat to eat that also?
Definitely. It's a well-balanced diet. Your pocketbook may not thank you for it, but it's quite expensive, but it is one of the things that you can, definitely, you can rule that, the dietary allergies in or out fairly well with using something like that.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling. Lisa in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a cat that has been in renal kidney failure for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've been through everything, and it's a roller coaster, and, she's almost died twice, and I do the fluids about 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
And she's on the, the kidney diet, and she gets a special powder in her food.
Mm-hmm.
And this past week, I took her for her checkup and for her blood work. And not only is she now in supposed excellent physical condition,
mm-hmm.
but my doctor was totally blown away because all of her numbers for her kidneys have dropped.
Well, good.
And she seems to be recovering.
Awesome. Awesome.
And he hasn't seen this in years. And my understanding is that this is progressive and, you treat it as long as you can and so on.
Yeah.
But how do cats ever come out of this?
Well, they don't usually come out of it, but you can see what's called acute on chronic renal failure, where they're trucking along with poor functioning kidneys, but not doing that badly. And then some insult happens. You travel and the cat doesn't drink and gets dehydrated, mm-hmm. or the cat gets constipated and is in pain and doesn't want to eat or drink. And that kind of can push them over the brink, make everything look bad, and you turn them around and then they can go back to where they were again.
Mm-hmm.
Cats, unlike dogs, can live with kidney disease for a very long period of time. Big things you want to be paying attention to, as you are, hydration, making sure that they're drinking and getting fluids all the time to make sure to keep them well hydrated. Watch their diet as well. There's special diets, but a lot of cats don't like to eat them. You have to keep the cat eating, but there isn't just one on the market. There's several out there that are very effective for improving the cat's quality of life. They're a little bit lower protein diets. Watching the potassium level. Cats that are in chronic renal failure, their potassium level will drop, and then that can throw their appetite off. So having that monitored, again, if they're well-regulated every 6 months would probably be fine. But the symptoms of potassium deficiency are a rough hair coat, muscle weakness, kind of inappetence, it's just very vague type signs. Having that looked at and watching blood pressure as well, because cats that are in chronic renal failure can be hypertensive. And so having that monitored at least a couple of times a year is in the cat's best interest as well. Lastly, because they produce dilute urine, they'll also have problems with urinary tract infections more frequently than younger cats. Cats under 10, urinary tract infections occur in less than 2% of the cats that come in with bloody urine. Cats that are older and chronic renal failure, you may not even know they have a urinary tract infection because they're peeing so much anyways that you don't know that they've got a problem. So getting cultures done a couple times a year to rule out silent urinary tract infections is important,
too. And that came back excellent as well this week.
Good.
Yeah.
Wow. So, good for you.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. It's just it's amazing, but I have heard that it is really a roller coaster. So
yeah, there is a website, and I hope I've got it right, but it's Feline CRF, chronic renal failure. If you just look up, you know, do a Google search on cat renal failure,
okay,
that'll be the first one that comes up all the time. And and it's excellent site that talks, shows you photographs on how to give the cat fluids, how to monitor them. Probably the best one out there.
Great. Thank you so much for your help.
Okay.
Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, I just went online to Feline CRF.
Yeah. There you go.
There it is.
Yeah.
First thing that pops up on Google.
Right, right. It's probably the best website there and very helpful for pet owners that have cats that have been diagnosed with kidney disease.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today here on the Ideas Network. Just to let you know, tomorrow we'll be taking a look at invasive plants and how to control them. And then Richard Louv, the author of Last Child in the Woods, will be our guest to talk about his book. I've read that book, and looking forward to hearing what Richard Louv has to say. And that comes as a result of several people who requested to have him on. So that's for tomorrow. But for today, we're talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. Dr. Sandy, the information out now is that we have some more contaminated pet food out there.
Oh, I just keep waiting for the day for it to end. You know, it's we've now found that acetaminophen, which is like Tylenol, has been located in some foods. And this is a real problem for our pets because, unlike us, we can tolerate it fairly well. Dogs and especially cats are extremely sensitive to it, even small amounts of it. And so, you know, right now there's not a lot of information out there as to how it got in there or what, you know, how much is in the food. But you need to be, people need to be watching for symptoms. And the big symptoms, especially in cats, are facial and paw swelling. They can have trouble breathing because actually what happens is the chemical, acetaminophen, affects the hemoglobin, and they'll get what's called methemoglobinuria and hemoglobinemia and become anemic, have trouble breathing, eventually can go into a coma and die. But it can affect the liver. Cats, very sensitive. Dogs, not as sensitive. But it's just something that, you know, another one of those things we have to worry about, you know. And I recommend to owners that they, you know, need to be on the ball and be following some of these websites that have up-to-date information. Two that I would recommend is the American Veterinary Medical Association's website, avma.org. And then the other one is actually the ASPCA website. And that would be the other one to be looking at. And it's the same thing, .org, ASPCA. So, yeah.
More to worry about. Let's go to Pat in East Troy now. Pat, hello.
Hello. Thank you so much, Dr. Sawchuk and Dr. Mueller, for taking my call.
Sure.
My golden retriever, who's a non-retriever, has terrible hot spots, and they seem to be seasonal, which means four seasons of the year he's likely to have them. And I've been stopping him from licking them and making him climb in the bathtub and let me wash it off every time, but I don't know if I'm preventing him from curing himself or helping.
Yeah. Well, you know, things to be doing. Make sure your dog is kept groomed. No mats or anything like that where the skin can stay moist. If you do get a hot spot, it's just an oozy, creeping skin sore. I don't know if anybody's ever had a mosquito bite where you've scratched it to the point where it's raw. That's what this is. But imagine that the infection is creeping underneath the hair and just spreading. I think every dog owner that has a dog that's prone to hot spots should have a pair of clippers at home so you can clip the hair very short, back to normal skin, so there's no hair laying over it. That'll help dry it out. One of the simple over-the-counter solutions that you can get at a drugstore is made by the Bayer Company, and it's an astringent solution called Domboro's solution. It comes in little packets, and you can mix it up with water and actually just, you know, apply it with a wet rag over it. That helps dry them up as well. for some dogs, they need to be on, if it's left go and it's pretty oozy, they need to be on an oral antibiotic as well for sometimes, 3 weeks or so to be able to get the infections under control. So, be on the lookout for these. They can pop up literally. You can leave for work in the morning and come home at night. I've had a Basset Hound that used to have this, and they'll have a big raw spot that you need to deal with. And knowing how to deal with it at home is going to save you a lot of grief if you can catch them early and get that hair clipped away.
Well, I've been clipping him away. He looks like a very badly
patchwork
coat.
Yes, right. Yeah.
But
and then looking for other underlying reasons too. Does he have allergies is there anything that you can do to supplement his diet with things that may help? Either using a skin sensitive diet like DD that Hills makes, or Waltham, Royal Canin have a line of skin specific diets. Basically, they've select protein sources along with elevated levels of essential fatty acids and antioxidants and so on, and it really helps some of these dogs decrease their itching. And you can supplement your dog's diet with outside things as well. Antihistamines, as we talked about earlier, topical steroid sprays may be helpful as well to help decrease some of the itching. So visiting with your vet and getting a nice little treatment basket put together so you can be working on your dog as soon as one of these pops up.
I've been using an old bottle of Physohex soap on his sore spots. Am I doing him harm or good?
Well, it's an antibacterial soap, and for some of these spots, if they're not healing and they're not scabbing over and drying up quickly, you're going to need to be looking at an oral antibiotic you need to get something inside the body to get the infection under control. And remember, you want to treat skin infections for at least a week post-cure. So the minimum amount for most dogs is you're looking at 3 weeks of treatment. It may be even longer. It could be as long as a month. If you just do it for a week and it looks like, it's cleared up, you want to go for another week after that because it takes longer to reach therapeutic levels in the skin. The skin doesn't get as much blood supply as other organs, so it takes longer to clear up infections.
Oh, that's wonderful. Very valuable information. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks, Pat. And Erin in Okano, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Erin.
Hello. I just wanted to bring up something else about the bloat. A couple years back, we had a collie, and she liked to jump off the end of a dock at a lake we would go to and jump in to get her toy and swim back in. And turns out to find out later, through problems and issues, our dog did get bloat that we weren't able to catch in time.
Mm-hmm.
Finding out later on that some lakes between Wisconsin and Upper Michigan, the algae goes into bloom once a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the algae was in bloom at the time that she was jumping into the water. So it bloomed even more inside her stomach. It was nice and warm inside the stomach, and it bloomed even more in there. So I know on the DNR, you can find out through the DNR which lakes go into bloom at what time. They can give it estimated time. And every time she jumped into the dock, she got a mouthful of water every time she jumped in, and that's what had caused that. And unfortunately, it wasn't known until it was too late.
Most of the algae toxicity things that I've read and seen are primarily neurologic problems that are associated with algae toxicity from dogs drinking water in the lake. And I'm just wondering if it's just the mechanical drinking so much water and exercising so hard and having a breed that's predisposed to it as well. There is a surgical method of tacking the stomach down that some veterinarians may be recommending to you, which I think is not a bad idea. If you're going to be going in the abdomen to spay the animal or do anything like that, it's a very simple procedure that may help prevent the animal from actually torsing their stomach. They may potentially could still bloat, but at least it won't twist, which is where it becomes really life-threatening for the pet.
Okay, and then I had another real quick question. I personally have a 5-year-old, 5-pound chihuahua, and he has been neutered. But ever since then, whenever he gets a little frightened now, he has to check his privates.
Okay.
Make sure they're still intact. Is this normal, or did I, emotionally scar my dog?
Oh, well, I think it's just a funny behavior that he's developed, and it may be that just at one point where he was scared, he turned to look, you paid attention to him, and he got what he needed. He got that moral support from you, so now he's just, okay, turn to look at your privates, and that's what gets mom's attention, and, then I'm comforted, because you're like, oh, what's wrong? So yeah. Just probably one of those things that got linked together, and now it's just become his habit. So, kind of a weird way of dealing with stress. But
weird
yeah,
way.
Each his own, yeah.
Didn't want to feel too bad about it, but it was good for him to go in and get that done.
And you,
that's right.
That's correct. And you were that you were the best owner to do that. Yes.
Thanks, Erin.
Thank you.
Bye bye. All right, Janie in Fitchburg. Hi.
How you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, I'm a grandmother, and I have four grand dogs. One grand cat and two grand birds.
Okay.
And the latest addition is a little bulldog puppy named Maxine Violet, and she is just a doll.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering, Dr. Sandy, if you know of any beginning puppy classes that a grandma and a 7-year-old grandson could take Maxine to.
Oh, that's a really good question. And, you know, there are many places that offer classes, and you want to be probably calling and interviewing the people to find out that are offering the classes, you know, just their training methods that they like to use.
Mm-hmm.
My preference is, you know, real gentle, what I call family dog training, where it's going to encourage family members to all be on the same page with training so that family members can attend. And it's not just going to be a one person, one dog type of thing where you have to go home mm-hmm. and relay everything to the family, that they use food rewards, that they're not putting the dog on a choke chain as a young puppy,
right.
that they're making it fun, not only for the dog, but for you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get the opportunity, you know, go and see if you can sit in on a class and just see, do you like the training methods? I mean, I've had people go to training classes and just be yelled at and belittled, and they don't want to go back again. And so,
right.
unfortunately, then they think all training classes are the same, and they're not. There are many, many good classes out there. And I really don't feel this is a forum for me to be able to promote my favorite people and places, but
right.
talking to your veterinarian.
I'm a specialist.
Oop.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, good for you for thinking about this. You want to make sure that the dog is started in puppy kindergarten probably in the next few weeks to
mm-hmm.
really, you know, use that early socialization time to your advantage.
Right. Okay. Thank
Good
you
luck.
So much.
Yeah. Thanks, Janie. Thanks.
And
for
bulldogs fun. Can be trained. Just because mine aren't doesn't mean that this little puppy can't be. Yeah.
All right. Kim in Boulder, you're next. Hi, Kim.
Hi. How are you?
Great.
I am so glad I caught your show driving through town. I have a question about a 7-year-old female Siamese that I have who licks her hair off.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought her to the vet about 2 years ago, and the vet thought psychogenic alopecia.
Okay.
We had a really bad experience at the vet. My cat, she's very nervous, and she had a really bad experience.
Okay.
And since then, I mean, it's been going on for 4 years, and it seems to get better sometimes when we're out of town, and we've since moved to Boulder from Georgia, and I'm wondering if it could just be allergies. She has what
yeah.
looks like small pimples and real bad dandruff.
Yeah, it's. Thank you for calling on this. In the past, we would think that for many cats that would just kind of barber their hair coat down to, you know, smooth skin looks normal, but they're just licking their hair off in spots, that it was a psychological problem, that there's stress, just like a person biting their fingernails to the quick, the cat's going to be grooming themselves. Most veterinary dermatologists now think that there's probably some underlying medical reason for it. And even though, you know, there may not be any other outward signs of allergies or skin infections or parasites, you need to look for it. I'll give you an
okay.
example of one of the last cats I had in. Beautiful, normal skin, just licked it bald where it looked like it had been shaved for surgery. And the cat
yeah.
just did it on its abdomen. We did a stool check and we ended up finding a mite called a Demodex mite that was living in the hair follicles of this cat and probably making the cat itch. It's very different than Demodex in dogs. So, you know, treated the Demodex, the problem went away. And it just was one of those fluky things that we happened to find it on a stool check. But if I probably had gone and done some good skin scrapings and things, I probably would have found them as well. So I think, you know, rather than just chalk this up to this is a psychological problem, it may be worthwhile to take your kitty in and get some workup done. Impression smears, skin scrapings, maybe even considering some allergy testing and go from there. You'll probably end up finding an underlying reason.
Okay, so would you recommend that I bring her to a vet dermatologist specialist then?
You can do that, but most veterinarians are very happy to, because skin problems are so common, we all deal with them. If they feel they can't get to the bottom of it, then, you know, going on to a specialist may be in your cat's best interest.
Okay, well, that's great, because we just feel guilty every time we see her.
What's interesting, though, is she gets better when the family goes away.
Yeah, we travel a lot.
Yeah.
And so we think she's allergic to something in our skin. I mean, we can't figure out
very
what
bizarre.
Is going on with
very
her.
Bizarre. Okay, well, hopefully you get to the bottom of this.
We're happy to have you. Happy to have you visiting from Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim. Thanks a lot for calling. All right, Kathleen in Park Falls. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling. I have a small poodle. I think she's a high end of a teacup.
Mm-hmm.
And I was walking her one day, and I met a casual friend, and she seen me with her collar and leash, and she says, get her a harness. She said, we just had to put our dog down. And she suffocated, her trachea collapsed.
Uh-huh.
And she said it was the worst possible death you'd ever want to see.
Oh, my goodness.
And they said, the vet said that they were prone, more or less, that little trachea.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed whenever she drinks water, she sounds like she's choking.
Okay. Yeah. not have anything to do with her trachea.
Okay.
But poodles and many small breeds of dogs do have, instead of reach up and feel their neck right now, you can feel
uh-huh.
your windpipe or trachea. It's
mm-hmm.
got little rings of cartilage all the way
right.
down. That's what you can feel, the bumps. Instead of being rigid like ours is, it's very soft and pliable.
Mm-hmm.
And so problems with, if they're pulling on their collar or they get anything that irritates their neck, even if they get excited and start breathing faster, it can
mm-hmm.
cause the trachea to collapse. And so if we've got a dog with symptoms of collapsing trachea, definitely things that you want to do, use a harness rather than a collar.
Mm-hmm.
That helps take the pressure off of the windpipe. Keep the dog skinny. Keep it slender as well, because that extra fat's not going to help either. And, you know, and you're going, oh, yeah, my dog's probably a little overweight. The choking when she's drinking may just be a function of, you know, how she swallows and things. It may not have anything to do with her windpipe.
Okay.
But if you're hearing a goose honky type cough, especially when she gets excited, then that would be, you know, something that would tell us that we better go ahead and, you know, use a harness.
The water
mm-hmm.
thing, and she, I guess she should be about 6 or 7 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 10.
Oh, well, that would be, you know, like a human being,
I know,
300 rather than 200.
I had her down to 8.5, but we had this terrible icy winter, and I couldn't get her out to walk.
Well.
So, and that's my excuse.
Now you don't have an excuse, so less
calories.
Get her
out there, Kathleen.
Yeah.
I also have one other thing. When we adopted her, she was a year old. She was in really bad shape. And she had a scar from her neck down almost to her tail. And
on the back?
Yeah. Huh. And no matter what vet we've had her at, nobody can figure it out.
Huh.
It doesn't look like a surgical, and finding the one I have now, he thought maybe somebody overdosed her with that flea stuff that they, or whatever they run down their back.
Huh. Well, there are some dogs will react to the topical flea medications and may lose hair at the application site. For the most part, the hair may come back. There's rare cases where you may not have hair coming back. And we usually don't run it from stem to stern. We just put it on just up in the neck area. So I have no idea. It could just be a little birth defect, you know, that...
It doesn't look. I mean, because it's kind of like a little... I kept thinking she was so neglected that I thought maybe she had tried to escape underneath a fence
maybe,
or something.
Maybe.
Could be.
But anyway, she's wonderful, and we love her.
Good.
And I'm going to get a harness.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kathleen. Thanks for calling. And you know, these harnesses, well, it depends on the size of the dog, but there are some harnesses now that
do up in the front.
That
yeah.
do up in the front.
Right. There's one brand that just comes to mind is called the Easy Walker. And I love those harnesses because dogs tolerate them well. There's less pulling. Many people are going to that over using a head collar or a choke collar. They seem to work very, very well. And you can just get them at pet stores now. Many dog training centers will carry them and help you fit the dog correctly as well.
Yeah, and it fits underneath the chest as
right.
opposed to on the back.
Back, right.
You don't
right.
want the
yeah,
strap back
if you,
there.
You know, when you use a harness that does up on the back, that allows the dog to be able to pull because yeah. that's, you know, it's like a sled dog. Now it's you know, can just pull right against you. You have no control over the dog. They can pivot all the way around.
Let's go to Bob in Minocqua next. Hi, Bob.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
A comment first. The lady about the hot spots. For years and years, I'm 71. I've had, nine dogs in my life. And I also worked for Beecham Labs in the veterinary division for 31 years. And one of the best products I ever found, for skin problems such as that was sulfadine. Now, I'm told that the new sulfadine ain't quite the same.
Huh.
But it worked like a miracle in the past.
And my guess is that, when I was a vet student and working as a high school, in high school for a practitioner in the late 60s, early 70s, we would make up salicylic acid, boric acid type solution. He would actually compound it himself, and it was acidic and drying, and that's the big thing, is drying these things out, having something very astringent, and I'm sure that that's probably what that preparation was, stuff we use, they called it Saltan, but and drying it up, and that's where getting the hair away and having it dry up. Is that still available? I don't think it is.
I think so.
It is. Okay.
It seems to me I've seen it yet.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
The bottle's downstairs and I'm upstairs.
Okay.
So I can't tell you what's in it.
All right.
The other comment and question, I've had three dogs that have, the phone's beeping. It's going to go out. I've had three dogs that died of seizures, and mm-hmm. all this since I started using these little pour-on tubes on the back, the capsule-type things for ticks and fleas.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering your comments about how safe, because they kill by the nervous system in the insects.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm concerned that they're affecting the nervous systems in the dogs.
Yeah, and it depends on the product that you're using, because some of them affect the parts of the nervous system that we don't even utilize. Imidacloprid is really not toxic for us, but that's flea toxin. Things like Frontline not absorbed mm-hmm. systemically and works on neurotransmitter systems in the insect that are not there in our skin. So it appears to be very safe, but epilepsy is just very common in certain breeds of dogs. Mm. I don't know what kind of breed of dogs you have, but poodles and
Springers, mostly Springers.
Okay.
Yeah.
And one little black mutt, and now I've got a Cavalier King Charles, and I'm almost afraid to put anything on her.
Yeah, but tick diseases, boy, they're out there. So, again, this would be something to talk to your veterinarian about, and I think that if you were to stick with, something like Frontline, you're probably going to be very safe compared to some of the over-the-counter products.
Yeah,
I hope you're right. I like Permethrin. I think that's a great chemical.
Well, that's probably the one that causes most of the troubles for us.
I think so.
Yes.
That's why they say not put it on your own skin.
Right.
Yeah, but pants and shoes and stuff, it's good.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We got time for Sue and Madison. Hi, you got a quick one?
Yes. Well, I just wanted to mention that my a friend of mine who lives in the La Crosse area, this is regarding dogs with allergies that manifested in the skin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The vet there was just totally stymied, and they ended up taking the dog to a place in La Crosse called Allergy Associates, the mm-hmm. vet referred. And that company apparently treats humans with sublingual immunotherapy. That's their main focus.
But they do pets
real
as well.
Extensive testing, and then they found what they believe are the allergens, and they create custom drops for under the tongue.
Okay. Probably a homeopathic type treatment, and boy, that's not my area of expertise.
And I'm sorry we're out of time, Sue. Thank you for calling, and Sandy, thank you. You'll be back again.
I will be.
And we will do this all over again. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And glad to have you listening, too. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.